Basically, what we're going to do is have sort of a current update on the work that WEACT, Women's Equity and Access to Care and Treatment, has been participating in Rwanda. And we changed the format just a little bit. I'm going to start with the adolescent work. Then Mary Fabry is going to discuss the mental health issues. Then the legal program that Lucy's going to discuss comes sort of after that, because it grew out of the issues that, of mental health issues that the women experienced. Then Anne Christine is going to discuss WEACT's work in the context of some of its successes and lessons, and then compare that with and build on what issues she's found in other East African countries. Okay, so it's very small, nice group, so you should feel free to engage us directly. We can't figure out how to move any of this down there, so technologically, so we'll just sort of use it up here, but welcome your input whenever you want. So what I'm going to do is start with that. Actually, myself and all of the presenters have no personal financial relationships to disclose. We are glad APHA asks for that. So I'm going to just spend like 2 minutes giving you the general approach that WEACT has used and found successful in Rwanda, and why we're there, and what we've been doing for the last 4 years. For those of you, just a few of you that might not have, might not know what we're about. Basically, in 2004, Anne Christine Dedeschi organized a trip to Kigali because several women's associations in Rwanda had spoken with her. Leaders of those associations had spoken with her in her role as an activist and a journalist, and shared with her that many women in Rwanda in their associations who had been raped during the genocide were ill, getting sicker, and had no access to medications for HIV. At the same time, men who actually were the perpetrators of those crimes were in prisons and jails in Rwanda, and they were getting access to medications. This was in 2003 and early 2004. Our role in going to Rwanda at that time was to talk with these associations, sort out a way to partner with them to, in fact, fast-track medications to these women. Now, again, this was the time when very few countries in Africa had, the scale-up hadn't happened yet, whatever we say about it now. PEPFAR hadn't started giving money yet. The Global Fund hadn't made its 3x5 goal, and things were really sort of at an earlier moment. And for us, we sort of saw the issue of these women and the gender-based violence that they faced during the genocide and the sequelae of trauma, post-traumatic stress, poverty, and HIV infection as something that sort of created a human rights agenda that needed to be addressed. And it was in that context that WEACT began to talk with the women from these other partner associations, these associations which later became our partners in CARE and WEACT, about how to actually provide care and actually begin to provide it. Because Rwanda is a very small country, one can't actually do much and wouldn't want to do anything without the leadership and integration with the Rwandan public health care system. So with many meetings and workings, though still quite a small group that was entering into the Rwandan public health care system, we began providing care. And just the one lesson that I always share with medical folks that I just want to say was, again, this was the women in these associations bringing women who were the sickest to our clinics that were set up. And they were started in July 2005. Now we have 3 clinics and over 5,000 people, men, women, and children, have been seen. And over 1,000 are, actually probably 1,400, have received antiretroviral therapy. But in our current clinic setting, we're giving ARVs to about 1,000 people. But what happened from the very beginning was that the women who were the sickest in these associations, and it's not like, an association leader could tell that someone's CD4 count was very, very low when they decided to bring women to the clinics. They obviously couldn't. They didn't even have CD4 counts, you know, like that had been drawn yet. But they could see people who were sick. They could talk to people and find out how they thought they got infected, what the rest of their story was. And they actually did bring the women in, and we sort of graphed this in a way that the women with the lowest and most suppressed immune system were brought in first, were able to get medications, were actually able to live, and most excitingly for us, tell us how to actually make a good program. So we now have three comprehensive medical and psychosocial clinics. We have a research program that goes along with that that was initially funded by NIH supplemental funds, but not at the moment. And we have about 90 Rwandan employees that do a lot of work that we're going to share with you right now. And I told you the number of patients. And what I'm going to concentrate on for the next 12 minutes is the increasing number of youth and with HIV and that we are seeing in our clinic and what issues they present to us. So basically, globally, the young people with HIV is a major issue, with people between 15 and 24 years of age accounting for 40% of new infections. And almost 6,000 young people between 15 and 24 are infected each day with HIV. And there are estimated about 5.5 million young men and women living with HIV, with the majority actually being female. The female issue of this sort of is that in sub-Saharan Africa, it's basically a 3-to-1 ratio, with 3 young women ages 15 to 24 infected with HIV for every man. In South Africa, an estimated 14% of young women and 4% of young men in that age group are living with HIV. And in some countries in the Caribbean, young women in this age group are more than twice as likely to be infected with HIV than young men. And actually, in our country, if you look at new infections, we see quite similarly higher, equal to higher rates among young women and girls than young men. And I show you Asia statistics there as well. In Rwanda, the population is approaching 10 million. The median age of people living in Rwanda is 18.7, so you see that sort of half the, you know, the majority of people are in the group that we're talking about in terms of both risk, new infections, and the care needed. Rwanda, of course, has, in addition to the orphan problem related to HIV, where there's about 200,000 children who fit that category, there's also a very large group of children who are orphans related to the genocide and other causes. We found that, and actually, the literature shows that depression is really quite common among Rwandan youth, and this is from an article that came out a couple months ago, where almost 500 kids, about 500 kids were looked at and interviewed, and they were orphans, with 70% of the parents having both parents died, and a quarter of them reported at least one parent died, and one-fourth of them indicated that a parent had been killed in the genocide. So the genocide issues, as well as HIV issues, are big ones in Rwanda for youth, and over half of them had depressive symptoms. It's not surprising, but people do studies like this. Three-quarters of them agreed with the statement that the community rejects orphans. Only one-fourth could say that they had at least one friend. 64% of them said that they had lost confidence in people. And 40% agreed that with the statement that life was meaningless, or reported losing faith in God since the deaths of their parents. So this study really rang true for those of us who have been working in Rwanda and in WEACT, and I think rings true in other places where children have experienced such devastating events. And The other part of it, in addition to a loss of parents in sort of a violent situation or a post-conflict situation and a conflict situation, is the issue of abuse that we find is very significant for young people. And the sexual abuse of children and teens is considered like a major way that a child gets HIV is actually through sexual abuse, either between a young girl and an older man, sex between adolescents, or incest. And people, I think, agree that we sort of have to address this, in part because sexual abuse exists everywhere in the world, and like violence against women, sex abuse is a matter, at this point, of societal norms. Many groups understand that the girl who's actually lost her mother to AIDS is emerging as the most vulnerable child in Africa. So what we have found as the issues that the kids have told us the most about is that they're very concerned about disclosing their status among their families. And it's true that many kids with HIV, both in Kigali and in Chicago, where I also work, don't disclose to their families that they are infected. There's a high prevalence of sexual abuse that is discovered, is one of the ways that people are experiencing, and might be one of the ways people became infected. Stigma, obstacles to staying in school, both financial, emotional, physical, poverty and transactional sex, kids being told by their mothers or fathers or caregivers to go out and actually make money in this way in order to provide for themselves and their younger siblings, depression, as you saw some of that data from the study I showed, that I quoted. Hunger, a big deal, most kids say that they eat less than one meal a day, and responsibility for family that they feel. So what did we do? We sort of tried to address these issues in a sort of comprehensive medical and psychosocial manner. We have dedicated support groups that have grown from these issues, so that now we have one for 13 to 18-year-old girls who've actually had a history of sexual abuse, who share that with us, who talk about it with each other, older youth groups, young men and women who have children already, who are sort of under 20, a computer class, dance groups, what the kids say they want to make a difference, peer advocacy and a Sunday support group. Listening to the stories and validating, we have found the kids say absolutely decreases their isolation. Providing legal services related to property issues, family issues, and sexual abuse is very important. You'll hear more about that. We had a We at Girls exchange, which I'm going to share a little bit about, and sort of have hopes that we could actually provide a lot more services. This is a grandmother who you'll see other pictures of when we talk about the difficulties that families have. Her two children now are actually about 15 and 16 right now, and they've been in the program for actually 3 years. Both have a diagnosis of AIDS when they came and are doing really very well medically. One of them has a lot of cognitive issues that sort of have made difficulties in school and have a lot of issues that has to be addressed. This is our Sunday support group where there's over 250 kids who come and get a meal, do other things. They get transportation so that it doesn't cost them to go. There's a computer class that happens before that. Each Sunday, a dance group that they've started to sort of deal with a lot of their pressures and cultural issues that they enjoy. I'm going to show you a few girls that actually did participate in an exchange to Chicago. This is Josie Ann, who's 18, has HIV. Both her parents died from HIV. She does live with a cousin. She actually returned to school, and there had been a lot of press about the tour in both Chicago and in Rwanda, and actually she's been quite stigmatized, even though not everybody in the group was HIV infected. The press reported that everybody in the group was HIV infected, and it's been actually a struggle where people had to go to the school to try to relieve some of this stigma that she experienced. Marie Therese is 20 years old and infected. She's an orphan. Both her parents died of HIV as well. She lives with a grandmother, just finished high school, is waiting to go to the university. This is Claudette, who's 19. She found she was HIV infected recently. Her mother was HIV positive as well. Her father died during the genocide. Mother had an enormous amount of suffering and violence, including many brutal rapes. They're both survivors, and she actually started something called the Freedom School in Kigali after coming to Chicago and seeing a group there who actually have something called a Freedom School, where they take the lessons from the 60s and what happened in summers there. And basically she started this school to help deal with reconciliation among Hutus and Tutsis, as well as among HIV-infected and uninfected youth in schools. And that, I think, is a very exciting lesson that has come out of that sort of exchange of ideas among young people in both countries. And I will tell you about Claudine, but I'll actually tell you about Claudine a little later. This is Natasha, who's also infected. I have 2 minutes. Her father died and her mother remarried, and she's not able to live with them. She lives with her grandmother. She started an HIV stigma group in her school, and she's still in high school. This was our group with the mayor of Kigali when we spent a week in Kigali and a week in Chicago with all the girls. These are two young girls whose mothers are infected. They're not infected. They helped make a beautiful mosaic that the group was responsible for. They weren't part of the group because they were too young to fit the 16 to 19 inclusion criteria, but they were extremely helpful, and here's what was actually produced, a beautiful mosaic that is in a clinic called Nyachunga out in sort of the very rural part of Kigali, and I think really adds, it's really beautiful, and the people in the community really like it a lot. And I just want to end with Claudine's story. Claudine wrote the following. My name is Claudine Weriza. I am a Rwandan. I was born in 1988, the eldest of my family. My father died in 1994 during the genocide. Actually, I live with my mother and two younger brothers. After the genocide, our life became a nightmare, as with most survivors. During the war, I was separated from my parents, was in a Congolese orphanage. Following the traumas I had suffered, I became a very solitary child, didn't speak to anyone, was like an automaton. I lost at least 10 kilograms. I was afraid to be seen. I was returned to Rwanda by the Red Cross, and we relocated my mother, who had come to Kigali, the capital, in an effort to find a better life. Before the war, we lived in Kibwe, one of the former Rwandan provinces. I could not even begin to recognize my mother, as I told myself that it would be someone who wanted to hurt me, since people with whom I had lived before going to the orphanage had beaten me, insulted me, forced me to do work that was beyond my poor strength. They did not give me enough to eat, and I was obliged to beg from passers-by. I followed psychotherapeutic therapy, helped me to be reborn, to readapt to social life. I began primary school in good health after having been very sick and hospitalized for malaria. I was a good student despite problems finding money to cover educational costs. I finished the first cycle of secondary school with excellent grades, was chosen to write supplementary exams to obtain a state scholarship to continue my studies abroad. At the last minute, they asked me to do a medical examination, which required me to do an HIV test. I knew that my mother was HIV positive. It was difficult for her because she could not disclose her status to our family, as she feared the stigma. For my part, I never dreamed of being tested. I didn't see the necessity. When I received the results of the HIV test, they announced to me that I was seropositive. It was unbelievable. I was like the one hypnotized. It was beyond my forces. I did not understand how such a thing could happen. Nothing that warned me of such a diagnosis. When I told my mother, she also felt scandalized. She felt guilty, since it was probably through prenatal transmission. I saw my mother as a criminal. I saw the entire earth shatter beneath me. I spent an entire month away from school. I refused to even see a psychotherapist. I didn't have the will to live. A little afterwards, I joined a seropositive children's group through the organization WEAC, where I was treated. I began to see lots of children and adolescents in the same situation as me. I felt integrated in this environment. I finished secondary school in the math physics section, got good grades, was offered a place in the Rwanda National University in the Faculty of Computer Sciences. And sadly, Claudine actually, right before the trip when she was supposed to go with us, was killed in a bus accident. A UN truck actually went into a bus that she was on. And the loss has been very, very hard for all of us. So we dedicate the adolescent part of this talk to her today.